Hey there. Thanks for listening to Here and Now Anytime. If you like what you hear, we'd love if you subscribe to or followed the show in your favorite podcast app. Just look for Here and Now Anytime. And if you can leave a rating or review while you're at it, we would really appreciate it. It helps us a lot. And telling your friends about the show helps too. Thanks. Now, here's today's show.
Once the reality of, you know, the situation hits them, they start going somewhere else.
3 years into the pandemic, there's still a shortage of childcare workers. Why? It's Thursday, March 23rd, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Kalyani Saxena. Today on the show, we explore how low pay is creating staffing issues in the childcare industry. And we hear about a new podcast covering a murder from the 1980s. But first, let's turn to Idaho, where one hospital announced this week that it plans to stop delivering babies. In a news release, Bonner General Hospital in Sandpoint stated a shortage of physicians, fewer deliveries, and the state's legal and political climate were the main reasons behind the decision. Idaho has some of the country's most stringent laws restricting abortion access. Bonner's announcement means that come May, pregnant women in Sandpoint will need to drive 45 miles to another hospital. Deepa Fernandez spoke to Kelsey Mosley Morris, a national reproductive rights reporter for State's Newsroom. She's in Boise.
Kelsey, before we get to the political climate, for years, rural hospitals across the country have been struggling to attract physicians. But this hospital also says they've been delivering fewer babies. Why is that?
Well, they cited changing demographics in their community, which basically means that a lot of older people are moving in, and I think fewer younger people starting families are moving into their communities. And it's not a huge area, but it's a significant enough area that it draws close to 10,000 people, and they have a lot of tourism and things like that. But in Idaho in general, we've had a growing population of older people coming from California, from Arizona, places like that. And it's just making the overall age more advanced.
So we mentioned the political climate. The hospital said physicians are leaving, and the legislature, quote, continues to introduce and pass bills that criminalize physicians for medical care nationally recognized as the standard of care. And that's a quote coming directly from the hospital's press release. Can you remind us of the state's abortion restrictions and what they've meant for physicians there?
So the abortion law in Idaho is a near total ban on all abortions at any gestational age. And the law targets specifically healthcare providers. They exempt the pregnant person. There's no other individuals who can be prosecuted for this except the healthcare provider. And if they have to make medical decisions based on medical liability and their risk of being prosecuted, which it has a risk of 2 to 5 years in prison, I believe, and the revocation or suspension of their medical license. It's a heavy burden to be facing.
So the hospital is closing down their entire obstetrics unit, not just delivering babies. Can you remind us what obstetricians are concerned about getting in trouble for? Because there are a lot of cases where women with wanted pregnancies may need an abortion to save their lives, right?
Correct. And Idaho currently doesn't have any specific exceptions for things like ectopic pregnancies. Ectopic pregnancies are not viable. And there are plenty of scenarios where a physician wants to provide the best care for their patient and not have them go through pain or get to a point where they need to save their life. And there's situations where they know this will end in an abortion. But if they have to wait until that person is bleeding out or is experiencing such heavy bleeding and damage to their reproductive organs that they may be at risk for not being fertile in the future, those are really difficult decisions to face as a physician trying to care for your patients. One of their physicians was actually interviewed by This American Life a few weeks ago, and I've talked to her before as well about her feelings of how vaguely the law is written, saying that you have a good faith judgment of being able to save a mother's life, because there is an affirmative defense for the physician to save the mother's life. But there's no real specifics on what that stage has to be in order for that to be a good faith judgment. And so if you're constantly thinking about whether your decision is going to make you a felon or whether it's going to save someone's life, that's not really a choice that people want to be faced with when they're trying to provide medical care in their right. best judgment.
Now, the Washington Post quoted the state's Republican chairwoman, Dorothy Moon, and she criticized the hospital's statement about the political atmosphere. Moon said the real reason behind the change was mismanagement and, quote, an inability to position the hospital to accommodate declining demographics. Has the hospital responded to some of that criticism?
I don't think they have, especially in Northern Idaho. It's not a place where you'd want to be criticizing the Idaho Republican Party chairwoman. I think they've largely just maintained their silence on that.
Now, in Sandpoint, a lot of things are a 45-minute drive away, I'm told. But what are you hearing from women who are pregnant or thinking about it? 45 minutes once you're in labor can be the difference between your baby being born and safely and not.
It is definitely an uncomfortable situation to be in if you are pregnant right now. I mean, they're continuing their services through May, but anybody who's due in the winter time has to be feeling very uncomfortable with that, because in North Idaho, it's probably no secret that the winters are not great and the roads can be absolutely impossible at times. So the idea of having to drive 45 minutes if you're in distress or, you know, have some kind of heavy bleeding or something going on is really scary to think about.
Yeah. Kelsey Mosley Morris is a national reproductive rights reporter for State's Newsroom. Thank you, Kelsey.
Thank you.
Coming up, Here and Now producer Ashley Locke takes a deep dive into the childcare industry's staffing shortages. That's after the break. The childcare industry took a sharp hit in the early days of the pandemic, losing about a third of its workforce. When families stayed home in 2020 to prevent the spread of COVID-19, centers faced layoffs. 3 years later, the labor force has yet to fully recover. That means working parents who need slots for their kids end up on waiting lists for months or years. Here and Now's Ashley Locke reports that the challenge to retain staff basically comes down to low pay. Davina Woods leads these 4 and 5-year-olds in song. She says it's one of her favorite parts of the job.
To watch their eyes fill with wonder, it is the equivalent of watching a flower bloom.
Woods is the director of the First Presbyterian Child Development Center in Burlington, North Carolina. She says she's losing quality teachers who share her passion because their base pay starts at $16 an hour. She says one teacher with 17 years experience recently quit.
She literally chose to become a stay-at-home mom because it was more beneficial financially for her family than to come to work to pay for childcare.
On the West Coast, Angela Achillezon can relate to the financial struggle. She's raising a family and teaching at PTS preschool in the San Francisco Bay Area.
There's a stigma of like, oh, but you chose that because you love kids and, you know, it's a work of heart. Yes, and we also need to be able to sustain ourselves.
Now, teacher Angela, as her young students call her, is finishing up a master's degree so she can be an instructor for the next generation of early childhood educators. But it's a deal breaker, she says, when she tries to recruit college students to her field after they learn that the national average hourly rate for a teacher to little kids is $13.
Once the reality of, you know, the situation hits them, they start going somewhere else. They go into nursing, they go into social work, or they go and switch to other majors like psychology. So that's the sad part about it.
Ms. Diane is also known as Diane Barsotti. She's director and owner of Children's Corner Preschool in Winthrop, Massachusetts. She's been there 37 years and has mostly lucked out finding staff in her small town through word of mouth. One perk for her teachers, free tuition for their own children.
Because of that, I am limited to a pool of moms that want working hours or, you know, parents that want working hours.
Tuition there costs roughly $14 an hour, and their teachers start out making about $15 an hour. That's the minimum wage in Massachusetts. During the pandemic, Barsotti says a child care stabilization grant through the state has helped her bump up teacher pay an extra $3 an hour. She expects the funding to continue for at least the next few months.
So if anyone questions what we would need right now, it would definitely be funding to provide teachers with better salaries.
The experiences of Diane Barsotti, Davina Woods, and Angela Achillezon echo those of early childhood educators around the country. Advocates say child care centers operate on razor-thin margins, and simply charging parents more will not fix the problem. When you do the math, you may understand why. Without more federal investment, it's not just young families who will continue to struggle with the cost of child care, but their teachers too. For Here and Now, I'm Ashley Locke.
And now that we've heard about the challenges educators are facing when it comes to recruitment and retention, we also wanted to discuss potential solutions. For that, Deepa turned to Leah Austin. She's executive director of the Center for the Study of Childcare Employment at the University of California, Berkeley.
Can you start by helping us understand this workforce? There are many out there who believe early educators are just babysitters and should be paid as such. Is this true?
That is not true. Early educators are a very experienced, educated, and dedicated group of workers. Most of our early educators in this country are women. Many of them are women of color. We know that there are substantial wage gaps where, in particular, Black early educators are being paid less than their peers. The levels of economic insecurity are very high. And an important way to address that is to start with data.
So when it comes to wage gaps, data collection is one thing you want to help states improve as a tool to respond. Your organization is one of six that has partnered with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to launch a new National Early Care and Education Workforce Center. And that center's broad goal over the next 5 years is to help local governments ensure that teaching and caring for young children is done well. But Leah, you know this workforce is in crisis and many can't wait 5 years for conditions to improve. Federal pandemic money in the early childhood field is running out. What's the worst case scenario when that money goes away?
The worst case scenario when the pandemic relief dollars end is that there's no stepping up to fill in those dollars and to add more to it. In that case, the childcare system, we already have a system that has collapsed. It's just going to worsen the crisis and families are going to have less access to childcare. But I'm betting on the best case scenario. And I think in the best case scenario, we have seen communities, local governments, states have seen what is possible with public investment. And that is going to be the building block for additional public investment in our childcare system, in our childcare workforce, so that we have thriving providers who are flocking into these good jobs and ensuring that children and families have access to good quality childcare.
But Leah, I have to ask you, I mean, there's over the course of the pandemic, we've seen the numbers that so many childcares, daycares, preschools have closed. I think there are a lot of parents out there who are really worried about whether they might have access to a daycare or preschool come next year. Is that a valid fear?
It's a very valid fear. If parents are struggling with access today, it makes sense that they're worried about what happens when if we lose this pandemic relief funding and nothing else comes in. I think that parents and the early childcare workforce together are really good allies. Often I think they're pitted against each other, right? Parents can't afford to pay more. Teachers need higher wages. Where is that going to come from? There's a shared interest in realizing an effective, publicly funded early care and education system that will work for parents and their children and for the workforce.
Leah Austin, Executive Director of the Center for the Study of Childcare Employment at the University of California, Berkeley. Leah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, we hear about a terrible murder case from the 1980s that bound two families together for decades. This new investigation by the Marshall Project and WBUR explores how the criminal justice system works and for whom. That's just ahead. In 1986, one 16-year-old murdered another during a summer camp trip to the Grand Canyon. Jacob Weidman confessed and served decades behind bars. Then, at 46, he had a shot at freedom. But his victim's family was outraged. Only 9 months after his release, Jake landed back in prison. What happened? To begin to answer that question, reporter Beth Schwartzapfel from the Marshall Project spoke with Jake's father, acclaimed author John Edgar Weidman. His books grapple with race, justice, and trauma. But none of them tell the story of his son, Jake, a story that takes all the dynamics at play in a typical murder case and cranks the volume way up. We cover that story in Violation, a new podcast from WBUR and the Marshall Project. Here is an excerpt from episode one.
Would you be willing to read a couple of passages? I brought some of your books with me that speak to some of these issues.
Depends. I don't want to get into anything that even begins to feel like he said, she said, because that ain't going nowhere.
I flagged a couple of passages. Let me see. This passage here that I've marked with the red pen.
I don't know if I can read this, particularly after looking at that picture of him.
This is John Edgar Weidman, author of more than a dozen books, English professor, Rhodes Scholar, MacArthur genius. I've been reading John Weidman's books for years, intrigued first by his lyrical explorations of the criminal justice system, of racism and class and privilege, and then later, even more intrigued when I learned how these themes played out eerily, tragically, in the life story of his middle child, Jacob.
Is this you guys in Wyoming?
Yes. That's Jake.
Huh, look at that. Who are you with there?
When I finally arrived at his Manhattan apartment on one of the first blustery cold days this winter, it felt like I was walking into something intensely personal, something that as a journalist I'd been fascinated by for at least a decade, but as a human, I was mindful was a painful, private story. As a rule, John doesn't talk publicly about Jake, at least not directly. Even when he's asked about it by Terry Gross on Fresh Air, as he was in 1994.
Do you think you'll ever write a more extensive piece about your son, Jake, or is that something that you think you might never care to share in detail with the public?
Well, the advantage of being a writer is you talk about things in your own way.
Right.
And sometimes people can look at your biography and make guesses about what, in fact, you're writing about and thinking about. But other times they can't. And it's a complicated way of taking the fifth, if you will.
Years after he sidestepped Terry's questions, John is finally letting someone in to ask him about his middle child. And he has a specific reason. He'd like to see Jake get out of prison. This is not my reason for talking with John. It's my job to tell you everything I can find out about what really happened and why. Everyone talking to me for the story has their own reasons. Everyone has their own version of the truth, too. John Weidman can relate to that.
I'm a fiction writer.
and a novelist. I also write nonfiction. In my view, it's very hard to distinguish often among those genres, and sometimes it's impossible. And maybe they're all the same.
As a longtime fan of John Weidman's writing, I can tell you that much of it is animated by this idea that good stories contain some essential truth, regardless of whether they're actually true, or that in some situations, true accounts may in fact be less true than fiction. One of the people who I'm hoping will help me understand what's real and what's false is John's son, Jake Weidman.
This call will be recorded and subject
to... I talk to people in prison all the time. I'm used to the noise, the terrible sound quality, the robot lady constantly interrupting to warn you that you're talking to a prisoner.
An inmate at ASPC Tucson.
And it's costing a small fortune.
Your account balance is $26.
And your calls are being recorded, and you'd better hurry up.
1 minute remaining.
And I think, we're going to get cut off, but okay.
But ever since we started talking, in phone conversations I could record, and at in-person visits the state of Arizona wouldn't let me record, I've tuned all that out to focus on Jake, on the details he unspooled over weeks and months. Jake and I spent more than a dozen hours on the phone in 15-minute increments, and I visited him twice for 3 or 4 hours each time. He's a big guy, 6'1", 195 pounds, and like all the other prisoners, he wore an orange jumpsuit with the letters ADC for Arizona Department of Corrections in big black letters stenciled on his back and leg. His head is shaved bald, and in the midst of a COVID surge, he wore a janky face mask homemade from old T-shirts. Jake seemed to have earned a certain amount of respect and affection from the other prisoners. During my first visit, people kept walking by and handing him things from the vending machine— snack cakes and a little microwaved hot dog and a bottle of water. Jake Weidman was sentenced to 25 years to life. He spent 30 years in prison before being released on parole. Then, less than 9 months after he was back out in the world, Jake was yanked back into prison. And now, nobody knows if Jake will ever get out again. There's no end in sight. The details of that part of Jake's story, the parole violation that landed him back behind bars, well, for now, we'll just say they were very unusual. Much about Jake's case is very unusual, but much about it is also all too common. In looking at this case, there's a lot we can learn about how the system works and doesn't for everyone. In spending all this time with him, his family, lawyers, and others involved in his case, I've been trying to figure out what happened. Jake's family did not relish opening their personal lives up for public consumption. But with some prodding from Jake, his sister and brother and father each spent time answering my many questions, including, why agree to talk to me?
This definitely is both, I think, for the love of Jake, but also for the love of justice.
That's his brother, Daniel. For Jake, talking to me was a leap of faith. I mean, he has a famous writer for a father. It would have been much safer to let John tell it. John would, without question, see things from Jake's point of view. But Jake was clear. He wanted a reporter to look at what happened.
It's time for the truth to come out, and I want to stand on the facts. I don't want anybody to feel sorry for me. I don't want anybody to, you know, take my side out of sympathy or say anything like, well, you know, he's been in since he was 16 and 36 years and poor guy. And I want people to have a conviction that justice needs to be done because of the injustice that has been done so far.
I'm a reporter, so I believe in facts. I believe that if you talk to enough people and do enough research, you can get to the bottom of something. I'm also aware that some facts are unknowable, or what passes for a fact is just a matter of opinion, that you can stack up all the facts and still disagree about what they mean. In this case, here's what we know. Jake Weidman killed a boy when he was a boy. There are mysteries in the story, but the victim and who committed the murder are not among them.
In 1986, as a teen at summer camp, Jacob Weidman murdered fellow camper Eric Kane. As Eric slept, Weidman stabbed him twice in the chest.
The crime devastated two families.
Two fathers have lost their sons and don't know why.
This is reporter Ted Bartimus.
I was a news reporter for the Arizona Daily Sun back in the 1980s.
I asked him to read from an article he wrote in October of 1988.
Sanford Kane lost his son to murder in 1986, and noted Black writer John Edgar Weidman lost his son Wednesday to life imprisonment for the same murder.
Now, recordings of court and parole hearings are often comically bad to the point of being almost unintelligible.
What confidence can society have that Weidman...
And you may be shocked to learn that recordings of police interviews from 40 years ago are also not exactly high quality or captured with audio journalism in mind.
He seemed like a pretty normal guy.
So in this podcast, you're going to hear bits of these recordings, but you'll often hear me repeating what's being said. And in some cases where a recording is not available, you might hear a colleague reading what was said. With Jake, you'll hear our phone conversations more than anything else, because while I can record phone calls, Arizona wouldn't let me record inside the prison. I needed special permission just to bring a pen. But I promise that whenever I can, I'll play you the words of people in their own voice.
That was reporter Beth Schwartzapfel in an excerpt of Violation, a new podcast from WBUR and the Marshall Project. You can catch full episodes of Violation right here every Friday. So make sure you're subscribed to or following us to get the latest. This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. As always, there's so much more to read and listen to at our website. New today, we hear about a massive seaweed twice the width of the continental U.S. making its way towards the Gulf Coast. That's at hereandnow.org. Today's stories were produced by Jill Ryan and Ashley Locke. Gabe Bullard, Kat Welch, and Peter O'Dowd edited today's show. Technical direction from Caleb Green and Mike Moschetto. Theme music by Mike, Max Liebman, and Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Grace Griffin and Allison Hagen. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.